From MPB Think Radio, this is Money Talks. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotridge-Anderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. On Money Talks, we're always ready to take your personal finance questions. To fill time between your calls today, some things we hope to talk about, why it's not always a good idea to use your debit card. You're listening to Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. So good morning. Hope they're both doing well this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Kevin.
Nancy, we always like to start the show out with financial news in the news. So what's on your mind today?
Short selling. So, yeah, an odd kind of a thing. And Trump media has been saying that the reason their stock declined in value was there are a lot of short sellers out there. And short selling is a weird thing because normally we think about we're going to buy a stock and we're going to hold it. And when it gains in value, then we'll sell it and we'll make
money. Is that called long? Is that called being long a stock?
Being long a stock. But being short a stock means you're going to flip it. You're going to sell it first and buy it later. Well, how do you do that? You borrow shares from somebody else. So it's this really odd thing, and you have to be approved to do that. Everything has to be disclosed. But when you are a short seller, you are counting on the stock going down versus when you're a long holder, you're counting on it going up. And there is something called naked short selling.
Naked.
Yes, which is not
legal.
This
is too scandalous for public radio, Nancy.
It's not legal where you are placing the sell trade and you're not borrowing. And that is not allowed. And so the claim was that there was some of that going on. And that was leading to some market sentiment causing the stock price to go down.
So now with short selling, you're still trying to do the concept of buy low and sell high. You just, instead of buying low today and selling high tomorrow, you think you're going to sell high today and buy low tomorrow, which is the same thing, but just
backwards
timeline.
Yeah.
So you said that you borrow shares from someone?
Yes.
What is the incentive for the person there?
Most of the time—
You pay interest.
Well, but most of the time you may not even be aware that some shares have been borrowed from you. And then there's all this weird thing because if there's a dividend declared while you have borrowed it, then whoever you've borrowed it from, you owe them that dividend. Mm-hmm. So those are some odd things happening in the short selling market.
So actually— For folks who are interested in this and who have a lot of individual stocks, a lot of brokerages these days are allowing people to – previously, this is one of the ways brokerages made money. They held your shares for you, and they would lend them out. They'd make a little bit of money. That's how they kind of financed their operations, made things cheaper for you. They would all the while display that you still had that, say, Apple or 3M stock in your portfolio. So what a lot of them have started doing is, especially as more and more people talk about short selling, it's more popular news item in the past few years, is allow people to choose to lend out their shares. Now, you know, a large, highly traded stock like Apple or 3M, like nobody really cares. It's super easy to get those shares. If anyone wants to borrow them, they've got a billion people to go borrow them from. So it's super cheap to borrow them. But some more obscure stocks, they hold some small, weird micro cap stocks that someone wants to short. They might be willing to pay you a decent amount of interest. And it's just another way to hold on to your stock, but also make a little bit of money off of holding it. So that's an interesting thing that some brokers are offering.
So obviously they have to either give you the money back or give you your shares back when they've
done. Well, they have to give you your shares back, mm-hmm. which means they have to go out and buy the shares in the open market and replace that. For instance, if I borrowed a cup of sugar from my neighbor, I'd have to go to the store and buy more sugar to replace what I borrowed.
What? You don't just have a nice neighbor who's just going to let you have the sugar? That's crazy.
That seems like a very risky strategy.
Well, again, it's on the belief that stock price is going to go down, and that's how you win, versus being long where you believe the price will go up.
It has a different risk profile, certainly, than buying a share. Because when you buy a share, say you spend $100 buying stocks, the most you're ever going to lose is that $100. Say that stock just goes to zero. Not super – well.
Was the GameStop controversy? Was that, did short selling play a part in that? It seems like something like that.
A lot of weird market mechanics did play into that. So go back and listen to our episodes where we talked about that.
I don't buy from there a lot because I rent my video games, but it's nice to go around and look around in there. You always go to the clearance area. Then the overpriced stuff is actually halfway affordable.
There you go.
Ryder, what's on your mind this morning?
Yeah, so we have talked about interest rates being a big driver of stock prices lately. And so speaking of interest rates, we have a Fed meeting going on, I think, right now, or maybe they're just getting started. I don't know how late in the morning they get started. Last meeting release, they said in their press release that they do not expect to reduce the target interest rates until they've gained greater confidence that inflation is moving towards that 2% target level. So over the past month, then bond yields are up. So the bond prices are down because people are just not expecting them to lower rates this meeting. I looked at various things. The futures have a kind of a prediction market there, and it is a 99.5% chance that they are unchanged. Now, you look further on to September, it's where they kind of have a 50-50. Anyone's guess what's going to happen in September, but that's further out than people were expecting this year. Of course, if there is lower interest rates, that means money is cheaper, right? And people like that. That is generally good for stocks, generally good for people who want to borrow money and put it into
except
what?
What's really interesting now is what's happening in the real estate market, which is, even though we had a little bit of a dip, it's taken off again, and median home prices are going up. What we thought, those higher rates, which we're now looking at, upper sevens, bumping up to 8% on a 30-year loan, that would slow things down. But it really hasn't had the dramatic impact that we expected. And that's one of the reasons we're seeing a delay on this lowering the rates.
The lowering of the rates. Yeah. So, I mean, people are getting used to operating at these higher rates. I think we mentioned recently that Fannie Mae was still predicting 6 and 7% mortgage rates for the next couple of years. So while generally you see lower interest rates, if money gets cheaper, it's easier to buy these assets, the asset prices go up. But you also are worried about a surprise cut. You don't want the Federal Reserve doesn't want to surprise everyone, because if people are surprised by a rate cut, then they start thinking, well, what does the Fed know that we don't know? So it's a delicate balance that they're walking there.
And also, what's interesting is what's happening in the auto loan market, because we're starting to see some teaser rates being offered by different models, which says to me that, it's like there's this slowdown in these durable goods, and they've got lots of cars on the lot. They've got to get them moving, and so they're offering these special rates to get you in there.
And I think that's just kind of an interesting facet. While the interest rates are kind of unifying it, right? Like everything is impacted by interest rates in some way. There are all these different areas of the market where, say, they're selling a ton of F-150s, but not a lot of Camrys. Well, they might offer special financing on that Camry, even if interest rates are high on the F-150, because they want to get those Camrys off the lot or whatever. So there's different aspects impacting those interest rates, but it's very interesting to see how they are changing throughout the economy.
You're listening to Money Talks. Our website, moneytalks.mpbonline.org, is one way to hear past broadcasts. You can also download the MPB Public Media app for your smartphone. Then you get to listen to all the local MPB Think Radio programs on your schedule. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotter-Janderson, President of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, Portfolio Manager at New Perspectives. We're ready to take some personal finance questions this morning. Phone lines are open. Between your phone calls today, though, we're going to talk about a couple of things. We're going to start off our discussion by talking about why it might not always be a good idea to use your debit card. Before we dive into things, and one of the reasons I think that we're going to say why you would want to use a credit card versus a debit card is that it offers a number of protections that a debit card doesn't. But my question is this. The card in my wallet is both a debit card and a credit card. In other words, if I go to the grocery store or the big box store or whatever and I swipe it, it usually gives me an opportunity to say, is this debit or is this credit? Now, when you pick credit on the little machine, are you then getting the same protections that you would get from just a straight credit card?
I think you should be, shouldn't you?
I don't think so.
You don't think it does?
I don't think
but
so.
If you use it as a debit card, you have to put in your PIN.
Right. That's the
difference.
That's the main difference, I think, is it's do you want to put in your PIN or not?
But
it's still going over the same network, right?
Right, but
and
it's still, any card
and
does.
It's still transmitting the same information about your card. So when we're talking about somebody getting access to that network or that information, I mean, there's literally nothing else someone can get.
But
right?
but the difference being what recourse do you have if it gets taken with a debit versus a credit? I would say you need to ask your bank if there
Let's
is a
get
difference
a banker
in that.
On the
we
horn.
Do need a banker on the horn.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a good question. I think it's come up before, and I don't have not researched that particular question. I just don't. I have no reason to believe that there's any difference in protection there.
Well, the one thing I would ask the merchant if there's a difference, because as we've talked about in the past, sometimes the swipe fee is different for
debit versus
credit. So I would usually say, you know, which is cheaper for you? Because to me, if for convenience, I'll always pick credit because, as Ryder said, you don't have to plug in your PIN number.
So. I mean, it saves running it as a debit card can take. I feel like just takes a long time, partly for the putting in the PIN number, and we're trying to get out of there.
But when we talk then about debit versus credit, one of the things is, and Nancy, you've told us this frequently on the show, but you could be putting your bank account at risk if you're using it as a debit card.
Right, because if you use it as a debit card, that money immediately comes out of your account. If you use a credit card, that is a loan. And so if you get the bill on that credit statement and you say, that was not me, you can refuse to pay for that and they won't charge you until there's an investigation and they figure out, was this really you or did someone take your card? If it's a debit card, you can also say that wasn't me, but that money has already gone out of your account. And it's going to take some sort of investigation to figure out, was there something questionable? If there was, that money will go back in, but it may take a while for it to get back in there.
And I would think, are most bank accounts these days offering the debit/credit card? I mean, I think even the most basic ones are probably doing that, I would guess.
That's typical. And just in the last few days, I had to pull out my debit card because I went to the ATM machine. And I thought, gosh, I never use this card. So I keep that bank card strictly as debit, rarely using it, and then I keep a separate credit card for all my credit purchases.
Ryder, does anyone use checks anymore?
Yes. His age?
Why, I write checks every day.
No,
Kevin.
You don't.
No, I feel so checks are useful for a lot of times people have kind of a person-to-person interaction where that person might not take, for instance, like a PayPal or a Venmo or something. We pay our rent via check. We drop that off at our landlord's. And at the office, we have some contractors, particularly cleaning the office, who just take a check. For us, and part of that is convenience for us, having the records, just because it's a little more difficult for a business to open up like a cash app or something like that. That might be a little unprofessional of us. So checks have just a different kind of record keeping for us.
So one other thing about a debit card, and I've seen this, for whatever reason, I see this more on the pump at the gas station, but Ryder, occasionally they'll put a hold on some of the money in your account when you use a debit card?
Yes. So super common to see at gas stations. We've talked a lot about getting alerts on your credit card or your debit card. And so when I swipe my card at the gas station before I pump, you know, you put the card in, then it might pop up and say, you know, $99 charge. Sometimes they call it a charge. Sometimes they can call it a hold. And it'll say, you know, at Shell gasoline or whatever. But then afterwards, okay, so I bought $30 of gas. Then the $30 is the charge that goes through. And the reason for that is it's a case where you're presenting your car beforehand, but they don't know how much money you're gonna spend. So they want to go ahead and make sure they're approved for a certain number of dollars. And if you hit that $99 hold, you know, you're filling up your F7,000,000,050.
Your RV.
Your RV. You're filling up your RV. Or you're just sloshing it around. You know, you just have a kiddie pool full of gasoline in the back of your car. That is not advised. That's not an approved container for gasoline. Then you can hit that number. You can usually run it again there once you hit that number. It's not like your card is like, no, you've hit your daily limit of gasoline. But if you hit that hold, then it might just make you start over.
And again, Nancy, on this one, because the way a credit card works, there's no reason to put any kind of hold. I mean, you might have one on file at a hotel or whatever, but it's not going to tie up any of your money.
Well, similar to that will be your credit limit on that card. So you are only able to borrow against that up to that limit that you've been approved for. So if you try to go over that, that's when it gets kicked back out.
And I feel like it used to be gas stations, like you mentioned, were kind of the only place where it did a hold like that. I have mentioned kind of grocery delivery services. I've noticed that they also have started doing a hold on that. And they'll maybe tack on an extra 10% to the order because sometimes they'll do a substitution that might cost a few extra dollars. They want to make sure that the money is there if they do make those substitutions.
So let's go to the phone lines. It's Nicholas is calling in from Biloxi. Good morning, Nicholas. What do you have for us today?
Good morning. I was just calling because I had a comment. Y'all talking about the differences when you're running it as a debit or credit with your bank card. My credit union gives me a higher percentage cash back when I run it as a credit card as opposed to a debit card.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah.
Very good. Thanks for calling in and offering that. And so that's why do you think the credit union would do that? Is there something in it for
because
them?
Because they're getting a bigger slice of that purchase from the retailer.
This is Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. We're talking about reasons why you might not want to use a debit card. The next one, Nancy, you again, we've talked about this. You liked having credit cards for some of the reward points, but obviously you don't get those on a debit card.
Well, apparently you might be able to, depending on how you use it. But yeah, I do love my rewards, and I love the cash back that I get on the one that I use for the personal side. And Ryder and I have a little bit of a tug of war on the corporate card, where he's like, oh, you've used those points. You've gotten your gift cards already ordered, and he likes to get his cash back.
My thing with the reward points is I try not to use my credit card that often. And so I don't ever really seem to do enough to really generate any kind of cash back or points or anything. So I've never been big on the rewards thing.
So, well, you should use your credit card more often. Yes. Kevin, I think we found the solution here. There's your problem.
If you're not using the credit card, is it that you're falling back on the debit card? How do you usually transact business? Do you carry a lot of cash with you? Maybe we shouldn't tell everybody that.
Well, no, I would use my check cashing card most of the time.
So the debit card.
Right. And the only time I think I would generally use a credit card is for like an airline ticket or some sort of a larger purchase. But, Ryder, you've mentioned in the past, if you wanted to get in the game, as it were, you can put everything on your credit card, but you have to have the discipline, obviously, to pay each month, but sort of use that for all of your bills.
Yeah, correct. And so, for instance, if somebody is putting, say they spend $1,000 a month and you put $100 on your credit card and $900 on your debit card, why not just put it all on your – if all of those merchants will take a credit card, you've clearly got the money. If it's not an issue of I don't have the money – again, like we always say, you shouldn't be putting money on a credit card that you don't have – to pay off, or you are not absolutely certain you're going to be able to pay off. So we're never going to be advocating for spending more than you have or spending more than you can pay back on a credit card. We're simply advocating for shifting your purchases to that credit card so that you get the better protections, so that you get potential rewards.
And if you've had some problems with credit cards in the past, that's where people can get into trouble by, first of all, you don't even realize how much you've put on the card until you get that statement at the end of the month and you think, wow. And if you don't have enough money to clear all of that out, or if you just think, well, I'll just put a small minimum on it and let it roll over, then you're incurring all kinds of extra fees, interest charges for those purchases. And that's the danger. So as Ryder said, you have to be disciplined about that. And I do that. I use my credit card for almost everything. And then I have a pretty big credit card bill every month, but I know that's just part of my budgetary spending.
Well, I think in my case, it's because I've had some issues in the past with credit debt with debt and that sort of thing. So I guess I'm a little bit cautious in that.
And you should be. You should be. Yeah.
Money Talks is MPB Think Radio's personal finance broadcast. Kevin Farrell here with Dr. Nancy Lotter-Janderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. They're both chartered financial analysts, and Ryder holds the Certificate in Investment Performance Measurement from the CFA Institute. You know, one of the other funny things about sort of having some issues about credit card debt in the past and that sort of thing, and I've got it paid off, and I'm proud of myself for keeping it pretty much at zero balance for most of them. But as the month goes along and I check my checking account balance, I always panic because I've got too much money in there. I must have forgotten to pay something because I was used to having to pay, you know, hundreds of dollars each month on my credit bill. So it's like I said, it's funny because I'm learning that's like, don't panic. You don't have anything to pay off. That's why you have more money in your checking
account.
That's
a great thing. And yes. That means you have more to save and put in for retirement and for all kinds of other things.
Yes. And I've actually twice done something where normally I would put money in my little emergency funds. And twice in the last couple of months, I've actually done that twice in a month, which is allowed, I've understood.
It is. Yeah.
All right. Let's go to the phone lines. We'll start in Summit. TC is on the line. Good morning, TC. Go ahead.
Good morning. How y'all doing this morning?
Good. What do you have for us?
I have a 401 retirement 401 question. I took out a loan last year, you know, out of my 401 and basically paying it back. I could pay it every 2 weeks and everything. But I'm in the process of possibly maybe bettering my future and moving along to another employment. So I was calling around, and I called my retirement place and talked to a rollover specialist, and I found out in the process that everything in my 401k will roll over to the other company if I decide to go, but they said that the loan would not roll over, that I would either have to pay the loan off in full or the IRS will get their 20% tax on it, and then I would just get I got it down to $1,400, so that's about $300 for next year. So I was just wondering, what would be my best option to go ahead and pay that off, or just wait for the $300 for next year? Because I thought the loan would roll over too, but they said it doesn't work that way.
No, so they're right. Most 401ks will. All 401ks will roll over into something, and very often, yes, your new 401k will accept that old one and just kind of start you off in a healthy way. But no, they typically do not roll over the loan. And so what it looks like there, say you have $2,000 in your 401k, you borrow $1,000 from your 401k, and then you close that 401k or you move it to another place. Well, it looks like you've just taken out $1,000 and just tried to get away with it. So that's why that loan doesn't move, and that's why that loan is considered income. They just treat it like it's a withdrawal. Now, you may have the option of leaving your 401k where it is and continuing to make payments directly, you will need to arrange with the 401k company to make those payments, but they may not allow that. They may just say, hey, if you stop contributing, we're going to give you X number of days to pay that off, or we're just going to consider that in default. We're going to consider that a distribution. So that could be another thing to look at, because you're not required typically. You're typically not required to move your 401k once you change jobs. And if it's just a matter
depending on the size.
There's a lot of caveats to that. But and it sounds like you're already speaking to the right people. So I'll just, you know, call those same folks again, call that same number again and ask them, well, do I have the option of leaving my 401k here? And if so, can I continue to pay that loan myself? And if so, how do I do that? Make sure you don't get off the phone without being 100% confident. We were just talking about mailing checks, Kevin,
yes,
of where you're going to mail the check or what bank account you want to set that up with for the repayment. So that could be possible that you don't have to pay it off in a lump sum.
I like that idea of, because you don't have to roll over from a previous employer within a certain time frame unless it's a smaller account.
Yeah.
And usually the smaller accounts, it's usually around $5,000 below that, they automatically clear out because they don't want the headache of administering mm-hmm. all of that. But if you just leave it there long enough to get yourself clean with all of that and then roll it over at that time, that would be fine. The lesson here is, if you can avoid it, mm-hmm. do not take loans against your retirement, against your 401k, because you mm-hmm. get into problems like this.
Yeah, and they can be a useful tool in those times of need. But there's playing with a little bit of fire there. One other thing I would add. So you asked about the trade-off between paying it back and just paying the taxes on it. So normally, you might look at someone's income, you might say, okay, adding an extra $1,000, an extra $1,400, you said, to that just adds to your income. Now, what they mentioned there, that roughly $300, that's just like a default 20% withholding. Your taxes could be higher, they could be lower, but what they will probably include is a 10% penalty for early withdrawal, depending on your age. If you're under 55, typically with 401ks, and certainly below 55, and if you're over 60, you're in the clear. You're probably not gonna have a penalty there. But that penalty tax, it's just some dollars that you just wouldn't have to pay otherwise. And if you can work to pay that off and reduce that penalty, that is great. And of course, the other side is, we just love to see people maintain high balance. We just love to see people growing those balances. I hate to see something like this just reduce the balance when you just don't need it to be reduced.
Okay. Well, a great advice. I sure appreciate it. But I would have never borrowed it, but I've been with my company for 12 years, and, you know, all of a sudden I didn't know I was going to be making a move. So, mm-hmm. but I won't be borrowed against it again.
Good for you.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good to hear.
All right.
Great advice, and thank y'all. You have a great day.
You too.
Good question, TC. Thanks for calling in today. Let's stay on the phone lines. Next, we're off to Florida. Gary has a question for us. Good morning, Gary. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, guys. I appreciate you taking my call. I just recently retired from a big transportation company in Memphis, where I was listening to you guys locally, and moved down to Tuscola Beach. So now I have to remind myself to stream you guys. But the question that I have is that it's on interest rates. I am fortunate enough to where I get a pension from my former employer, and I also am retired military, so I get retirement from them, and I just started drawing Social Security. So my question on interest is that I've got a couple of CDs, but my deposits that go into, say, like my checking account, is only earning like 0.01%.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
On a checking account is paying. Okay. And so I'm looking to see, how can I maximize where these direct deposits for my retirement is going, so that I still have operating funds, but the funds that I don't need, you know, on a regular basis, that I'm making the most interest out of.
Well, Gary, it sounds like
are CDs my only option?
Not necessarily. You are certainly fortunate because you have some guaranteed streams of income. It sounds like it's way more than what you need to pay your bills every month.
He's done it right.
Yeah. So with basically two pensions and Social Security, you're pretty much covered. You can change where those deposits go. You can choose a good money market. If you're not earning at least 4% on a savings / money market account, you need to look elsewhere. And you can look at online banks to see what is being offered out there. You can have those checks directly deposited into that, or you can leave those deposits so that they go into a checking account, but you can, with just a few clicks of your keyboard, move it over on a regular basis to a higher earning account. Once you do that, once you have a certain amount of money, and for somebody who's retired, somewhere in the $25,000 to $50,000 in a good money market is plenty. Once you go beyond that, you might want to look at some CDs with different maturity dates on those. You can also look at some longer-term investing, bonds, stocks, mutual funds of some sort that contain both bonds and stocks, and then invest for a little bit longer term.
Okay. Okay. That sounds good, because my main concern on that was that I do have, I got them going into separate accounts. So I got one going into like my checking account, and that's what I'm using for like operating funds and just paying bills or whatever. I got a couple of credit cards, but I'm paying them off in full every month. So I just need funds for that. And then the other is going into, I have CDs that are paying 5%.
Good.
But I'm
yeah.
trying not to have to lock it in. You know, do I have to lock everything in? And can I deposit directly into a CD that I already have?
No.
Typically, no.
No, you're going to have to deposit into a savings account or a money market account. You should be able to do that. And, you know, with interest rates being as high as they are now, we are seeing some really good rates on those very short-term savings vehicles. So it doesn't have to be locked into a CD.
So I should easily be able to find money markets out there that are paying in the market range 4 to 5%.
Well, probably about 4%, somewhere around that is going to be great.
Okay. Okay.
All and right. Gary, thanks for streaming us. We appreciate it.
Oh, I've been listening to you guys for a long time. I've called in several times through the years. You've given me some great advice, and no matter where I am, I try to, like I said, I try to remind myself that, hey, it says Tuesday. Let me log in so I can listen to you guys. You give some great advice. I really
Thanks so much.
It.
Awesome. Thank you, Gary.
Thanks for the call, Gary. Enjoy Pensacola Beach. I'll be down there in about a week or so to visit my brothers. I always like going down to the Florida Panhandle for some downtime. Let's stay on the phone lines. Next, we're going to go to Horn Lake. Our friend David has called in today. Good morning, David. What do you have for us?
I got a question about probably branching out to an area that you may not have no expertise on, but telephone spoofing. I'm getting phone calls from people, won't know why I'm calling them, and I'm afraid that they've been able to clone or spoof my telephone number and maybe using it to maybe commit a financial crime or maybe calling a bomb threat or something. How can I protect myself, or can you give me some advice or whatnot? Because caller ID, you can't trust caller ID, and with that, but me not making any outgoing calls, I'm getting an average of at least a dozen phone calls a day, and I don't answer them, but they leave messages on my answering machine, won't know why I keep calling them, what do I want or whatnot. And I've called do not call registry list. I mean, do you have any expertise? Can you point me in the right direction how I can maybe fix the problem or slow it down?
David, is this on a landline or a cell phone?
A landline.
A landline. Oh, gosh, I don't know if they're going to be more susceptible at that point. And you're right. You can't trust the caller ID because I've even had the experience of my own number showing up on a caller ID with an incoming call.
Yeah.
And it's crazy. So there is some of that going on. I think probably the best thing you can do is not answer those phone calls, and hopefully those will go away. But I do wonder if maybe it's because the landline numbers are being used more than the cell phone numbers.
Okay, I can do that.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a whole lot of protection against having somebody spoof your number. It's not a super difficult thing for someone to spoof a number. You can Google it. You can find a website. You can do it probably for free today. You can spoof your own number. Never spoof someone else's number. That is fraud. But of course, if people are committing that act and using your number, I've had people call me back and say, why do you keep calling me? And I do not place a lot of phone calls on my cell phone. So I know very well I have not been placing phone calls to these people. So that's just really tough.
And David, I know you're a frequent MPB Think Radio listener, so I would recommend tuning in Wednesday morning at 10 for Everyday Tech. And I think that they might be able to get you some help. In fact, Abrams, our engineer, and he is the host of that show.
Yeah, I'm trying to look up as much as I can right now. Apparently, that's called a port out scam, where they move your phone number into another carrier. As far as getting that protected against that, and as far as, you know, having that happen in the first place, there it can literally happen to anyone. They can just guess your phone number. So call us tomorrow, or I don't think we'll be live tomorrow, or send us an email at everydaytech@mpbonline.org. And we'll try to get back to you. I'll send it to Sabir, our expert, and he'll definitely know more.
So, and that is a little bit different. I believe the port out would essentially allow someone to take your phone number. Then they would stick it on their phone, send and receive from there. We are getting well out of the money expertise, but this is, you know, we do read a lot about fraud. We do read a lot about scams. We do read a lot about this sort of stuff, which is used to perpetrate financial crimes. So the port out is a little bit more complicated because they have to convince, say you have a phone with Verizon, they're convincing Verizon to move the service to a different phone. And this is done by impersonating you. You know, there are protections you can have typically with your phone carrier. Major phone carriers, you'll have a password or a PIN that you have to use with them to make that sort of transaction. Of course, these can be guessed, or these can be stolen, these can be cracked, what have you. But the spoofing itself, just placing a phone call and making it appear as if it's from another number, that's, again, not an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. In fact, on our phone service, we can plug in what do we appear as on our caller ID. Now, that's not going to change the phone when someone looks at their call log and sees what number called them, right? Like, I can't change that number easily, but I can change what the display is. And I can just display that number as, oh, well, it's 911 calling you. I don't know. Hopefully they have some protections in place to keep me from doing that. But, yeah, it's a different sort of problem that's a little bit easier. And then people end up calling your number back would be the issue.
All right. So, yeah, David, again, it's everydaytech@mpbonline.org. If you'll send that email, Abram and his crew will see if they can't give you some advice on how to deal with that situation. We appreciate your call. We're glad you found our show, Money Talks. I'm Kevin Farrell, here with Dr. Nancy Lotridge-Anderson, president of New Perspectives, and Ryder Taft, portfolio manager at New Perspectives. We've got a caller on the line, so let's go to Gail, who is called in from Orlando this morning. A lot of Sunshine State calls on the program this morning. Good morning, Gail. What do you have for us today?
Hey, good morning. I am also a listener, formerly of Mississippi, living in Florida, and I've just followed you through the years. So thank you for your program.
We appreciate it.
I am considering changing financial advisors, and I want to understand basis points as that relates to the fee they are going to charge to manage my account.
Well, there are three basic ways advisors get fees. You may be a commission person, and there are plenty of good commission people out there, but if you use a commission advisor to help you, you need to make sure you understand that there are different commissions for different products that they get you to purchase. And any kind of information they give you is supposed to be in there. It may be in fine print, but it is your job to read that and make sure you understand that. You can ask them straight out, how are you paid? And they will have to tell you that. They also could be fee-based, which means they do sell commission products. They do earn commissions, but there may be an additional fee on top of that. And make sure you understand what those are and what is involved there. There could be annual fees in any account where you have your assets housed. So be careful about that. You could also deal with a fee-only advisor. We are fee-only advisors. There are no commissions at all. The fee is very upfront. If you sign a contract, that fee schedule is supposed to be in there very clearly lined out. They should explain it to you. If there are breakpoints, how is it calculated? All of that. And again, if you're dealing with a commission person, make sure you read the fine print on every investment that they talk to you about to understand the various commissions that they are paid and how they are structured. And in some cases, those commissions can lock you in for a long period of time, even if the investment is not a good choice for you.
And you also mentioned basis points. So we mentioned percentages. So a percentage, of course, is, you know, 1/100th of some number. A basis point is 1/100th of 1%. So it's just a way of describing, you know, 0.5% is 50 basis points. So some people kind of dismiss it as, you know, fancy finance people talk, but there are some good uses for saying basis point to discern. But essentially, yes, you can just translate it to a fraction or a decimal of a percentage.
And Gail, one other thing that we've talked about when we mentioned financial advisors is the suggestion to meet with them in person. This is someone that's going to be taking care of your money, and so it's someone that you want to trust. And so a face-to-face meeting allows you to kind of scope out who that is, and you need to feel real good about that person and working with them, because, again, they're going to be handling your money for you.
And ultimately, Kevin, it's about the value they give you for that fee. And, you know, some people that we sit down and talk with, they really want to manage their own money. They don't really need an advisor, and that's fine. So any advisor that you hire, there should be a reason where you need someone who helps you stay disciplined, who gives you a plan, who keeps you on track, and ultimately you want to earn money.
All right, Gail, we appreciate your call. Well, let's go to one final call, see if we can work this in. It's Mari in Jackson. Got about a minute left, so I think we can give you some quick advice. Go ahead.
Hello, got a real quick question. I got money in the IRS 457 plan, the deferred comp. And I was puzzled as to how to reallocate it between all the different options you have. I'm told that they're all good. Whoever works for the state picks out all good ones and puts them in there, so they're all the same. But I'm just wondering, if I reallocate them, how could I reallocate them? I'm a young cat, about 65, getting ready to retire. So I'm just trying to think about how to rebalance things.
Gotcha. Yeah. So, so the Mississippi deferred compensation, yes, it's part of the PERS board, PERS organization that puts that together. And yeah, I do think they have pretty good options. There's always going to be some valid criticism. They've made it really simple. They have, of course, target date options, but they also have just a passive bond and an active bond fund, a passive stock fund and an active stock fund for various categories. So they've done a good job designing it in that way. Typically, we're big fans of passive funds over the long term. Sometimes there are cases where you need a good active fund. You might want to, for specific advice, I know PERS doesn't offer specific advice on how to allocate. You might want to talk to an independent advisor
yes.
about that, who can look at those funds, look at your situation, and importantly, when and how you're going to need that money, because that's going to dictate how they arrange those investments in your portfolio.
And then when you make those decisions, I think it's easy to do on the website. So that is going to wrap us up for today. Money Talks is a production of MPB Think Radio, funded in part by generous financial support from listeners. To hear today's show or previous show, you can visit moneytalks.mpbonline.org or listen to the podcast by searching for Money Talks. So for Dr. Nancy Lotridge-Anderson and Ryder Taff, I'm Kevin Farrell, inviting you to join us Tuesdays at 9 for Money Talks. It's heard only on MPB Think Radio.